Chapter 10 The Law of Liberty. 825. Are there any positions in life in which a man may flatter himself that he enjoys absolute freedom? No, because all of you, the greatest as well as the least, have need of one another. 826. In what condition of life could a man enjoy absolute freedom? That of a hermit in a desert. As soon as two men find themselves together, they have reciprocal rights and duties to respect, and are, therefore, no longer absolutely free. 827. Does the duty of respecting the rights of others deprive a man of the right of belonging to himself? In no wise, for he holds that right from nature. 828. How can we reconcile the liberal opinions professed by some persons with the despotism they themselves sometimes exercise in their own houses, and among their subordinates? Their intelligence is aware of the law of nature, but this perception is counterbalanced by their pride and selfishness. When their profession of liberal principles is not hypocrisy, they know what ought to be done, but do it not. Will their profession of liberal principles, in the earthly life, be of any avail to such persons in the other life? The more clearly a principle is understood by the intellect, the more inexcusable is the neglect to put it into practice. He who is sincere, though simple, is further advanced on the divine road than he who tries to appear what he is not. 829. Are any men intended by nature to be the property of other men? The absolute subjection of any man to another man is contrary to the law of God. Slavery is an abuse of strength, it disappears with progress, gradually, as all other abuses will disappear. 830. When slavery is already established in the habits of a people, are those who profit by that institution to blame for conforming to a usage which appears to them to be natural? What is wrong is always wrong, and no amount of sophistry can change a bad deed into a good one, but the responsibility of wrongdoing is always proportional to the means of comprehending it possessed by the wrongdoer. He who profits by the institution of slavery is always guilty of a violation of natural law, but in this, as in everything else, the guilt is relative. Slavery having become rooted in the habits of certain peoples, men may have taken advantage of it without seeing it to be wrong, and as something which appeared to them altogether natural, but when their reason, more developed and enlightened by the teachings of Christianity, has shown them that their slave is their equal in the sight of God, they are no longer excusable. 831. Does not the inequality of natural aptitudes place some of the human races under the sway of other races of greater intelligence? Yes, in order that the latter may raise them to a higher level, but not that they may brutify them still more by slavery. Men have too long regarded certain human races as working animals furnished with arms and hands, which they have believed themselves to have the right of using and selling like beasts of burden. They fancy themselves to be of purer blood, fools, who see only matter. It is not the blood that is more or less pure, but only the spirit. 832. There are men who treat their slaves humanely, who let them want for nothing, and who think that freedom would expose them to greater privations. What do you say of such persons? I say that they have a better understanding of their own interests than those who treat them cruelly. They take the same care of their cattle and horses, in order to get a better price for them at market. They are not as guilty as those who treat them badly, but they nonetheless treat them as merchandise, by depriving them of the right of belonging to themselves. 833. Is there in man something that escapes constraint, and in regard to which he enjoys absolute liberty? Yes, in his thought man enjoys unlimited freedom, for thought knows no obstacles. The action of thought may be hindered, but not annihilated. 834. Is man responsible for his thoughts? He is responsible for them to God. God alone can take cognizance of thought, and condemns or absolves it according to his justice. 835. Is freedom of conscience the natural consequence of freedom of thought? Conscience is an inner thought that belongs to man, like all his other thoughts. 836. Has man the right to set up barriers against freedom of conscience? no more than against freedom of thought, for God alone has the right to judge the conscience. If man, by his laws, regulates the relations between men and men, God, by the laws of nature, regulates the relations between men and God. 837. What is the effect of the hindrances opposed to freedom of conscience? To constrain men to act otherwise than as they think, and thus to make hypocrites of them. Freedom of conscience is one of the characteristics of true civilization and of progress. 838. Is every honest belief to be respected, even when completely false? Every belief is worthy of respect when it is sincere, and when it leads to the practice of goodness. Blamable beliefs are those which lead to the practice of evil. 839. Is it wrong to scandalize those whose belief is not the same as our own? To do so is to fail in charity, and to infringe on freedom of thought. 840. Is it an infringement of the freedom of conscience to place hindrances in the way of beliefs that are of a nature to cause social disturbance? You can only repress action, belief is inaccessible. 841. Ought we, out of respect for freedom of conscience, to allow of the propagation of pernicious doctrines, or may we, without infringing upon that freedom, endeavor to bring back into the path of truth those who are led astray by false principles? Most certainly you not only may, but should, do so, but only by following the example of Jesus, by employing gentleness and persuasion, and not by resorting to force, which would be worse than the false belief of those whom you desire to convince. Conviction cannot be imposed by violence. 842. All doctrines claiming to be the sole expression of the truth, by what signs can we recognize the one which has the best right to call itself such? The truest doctrine will be the one which makes the fewest hypocrites and the greatest number of really virtuous people, that is to say, of people practicing the law of charity in its greatest purity and in its widest application. It is by this sign that you may recognize a doctrine as true, for no doctrine, of which the tendency to make divisions and demarcations among the children of God, can be anything but false and pernicious. 843. Has man freedom of action? Since he was freedom of thought, he was freedom of action. Without free will, man would be a machine. 844. Does man possess free will from his birth? He possesses free will from the moment when life possesses the will to act. In the earliest portion of a lifetime, free will is almost null. It is developed and changes its object with the development of the faculties. The child, having thoughts in harmony with the wants of his age, applies his free will to the things which belong to that age. 845. Are not the instinctive predispositions that a man brings with him at birth an obstacle to the exercise of his free will? A man's instinctive predispositions are those which belong to his spirit before his incarnation. If he is but little advanced, they may incite him to wrongdoing, in which he will be seconded by spirits who sympathize with that wrongdoing. But no incitement is irresistible when there is a determination to resist. Remember that to will is to be able. 846. Has not our organism an influence on the acts of our life, and if so, does not this influence constitute an infringement of our free will? Spirits are certainly influenced by matter, which may hamper them in their manifestations. This is why, in worlds in which the body is less gross than upon the earth, the faculties act more freely, but the instrument does not give the faculty. In considering this question, you must also distinguish between moral faculties and intellectual faculties. If a man has the instinct of murder, it is assuredly his spirit that possesses this instinct, and not his organs. He who annihilates his thought, in order to occupy himself only with matter, becomes like the brute, and still worse, for he no longer endeavors to preserve himself from evil, and it is this which constitutes his culpability, because he does so of his own free will. 847. Does aberration of the mental faculties deprive man of free will? He whose intelligence is deranged by any cause whatever is no longer master of his thoughts, and henceforth is no longer free. Mental aberration is often a punishment for the spirit who, in another existence, has been vain or haughty, or has made a bad use of his faculties. He may be reborn in the body of an idiot, as the despot may be reborn in the body of a slave, and the hard-hearted possessor of riches, in that of a beggar, but the spirit suffers from this constraint, of which he is fully conscious, and it is in this constraint that you see the action of matter. 848. Is the aberration of the mental faculties produced by drunkenness an excuse for the crimes committed in that state? No, for the drunkard has voluntarily deprived himself of his reason in order to satisfy his brutish passions. He thus commits not one crime, but two. 849. What is the dominant faculty of man in the savage state? Is it instinct or free will? Instinct, which, however, does not prevent his acting with entire freedom in certain things, but, like the child, he uses his freedom for the satisfaction of his needs, and obtains its development only through the development of his intelligence. Consequently, you, who are more enlightened than the savage, are more blamable than a savage if you do wrong. 850. Does not social position sometimes place obstacles in the way of free action? Society has, undoubtedly, its exigencies. God is just, and takes everything into account, but he will hold you responsible for any lack of effort on your part to surmount such obstacles. 851. Is there a fatality in the events of life, in the sense commonly attached to that word, that is to say, are the events of life ordained beforehand, and, if so, what becomes of free will? There is no other fatality than that which results from the determination of each spirit, on incarnating himself, to undergo such and such trials. By choosing those trials he makes for himself a sort of destiny which is the natural consequence of the situation in which he has chosen to place himself. I speak now of physical trials only, for, as regards moral trials and temptations, a spirit always preserves his freedom of choice between good and evil, and is always able to yield or to resist. A good spirit, seeing man hesitate, may come to his aid, but cannot influence him to the extent of mastering his will. On the other hand, a bad spirit, that is to say, a spirit of inferior advancement, may trouble or alarm him by suggesting exaggerated apprehensions, but the will of the incarnated spirit retains, nevertheless, its entire freedom of choice. 852. There are persons who seem to be pursued by a fatality independent of their own action. Are not their misfortunes, in such cases, the result of predestination? They may be trials which those persons are compelled to undergo because they have been chosen by them in the spirit state, but you often set down to destiny what is only the consequence of your own faults. Try to keep a clear conscience, and you will be consoled for the greater part of your afflictions. 853. They are persons who escape one danger only to fall into another. It seems as though it had been impossible for them to escape death. Is there not a fatality in such cases? There is nothing fatal, in the true meaning of the word, but the time of death. When that time has come, no matter under what form death presents itself, you cannot escape it. If so, whatever danger may seem to threaten us, we shall not die if our hour has not come? No, you will not be allowed to die. Under this you have thousands of examples, but when your hour has come, nothing can save you. God knows beforehand the manner in which each of you will quit your present life, and this is often known also to your spirit, for it is revealed to you when you make choice of such and such existence. 854. Does it follow, from the inevitability of the hour of death, that the precautions we take in view of apparent danger are useless? No, for those precautions are suggested to you in order that you may avoid the dangers with which you are threatened. They are one of the means employed by Providence to prevent death from taking place prematurely. 855. What is the aim of Providence in making us incur dangers that are to be without result? When your life is imperiled, it is a warning which you yourself have desired, in order to turn you from evil, and to make you better. When you escape from such a peril, and while still feeling the emotion excited by the danger you had incurred, you think, more or less seriously, according to the degree in which you are influenced by the suggestions of good spirits, of amending your ways. The bad spirit returning to his former post of temptation, I say bad, in reference to the evil that is still in him, you flatter yourself that you will escape other dangers in the same way, and you again give free scope to your passions. By the dangers you incur, God reminds you of your weakness, and of the fragility of your existence. If you examine the cause and the nature of the peril you have escaped, you will see that in many cases its consequences would have been the punishment of some fault you have committed, or of some duty you have neglected. God thus warns you to look into your hearts, and to pursue the work of your self-amendment. 856. Does a spirit know beforehand the kind of death to which he will succumb in the earthly life? He knows that he has exposed himself by the life he has chosen to die in some particular manner rather than in another, but he also foresees the efforts he will have to make in order to avoid the danger, and he knows that, if God so permit, he will escape it. 857. There are men who brave the perils of the battlefield with the full persuasion that their hour is not come. Is there any foundation for such confidence? A man often has a presentiment of his end. He may, in the same way, have a presentiment that his time for dying has not yet come. These presentiments are due to the action of his spirit protectors, who may wish to lead him to hold himself ready to go away, or to raise his courage in moments when he has especial need of it. They may also come to him from the intuition he has of the existence he has chosen, or of the mission he has accepted, and which he knows, as a spirit, that he has to fulfill. 858. How is it that those who have a presentiment of their death generally dread it less than others? It is the man, and not spirit, who dreads death. He who has the presentiment of his death thinks of it rather as a spirit than as a man. He understands that it will be a deliverance, and awaits it calmly. 859. If death is inevitable when the time appointed for it has arrived, is it the same in regard to all the accidents that may happen to us in the course of our life? They are often small enough to permit of our warning you against them, and sometimes of enabling you to avoid them by the direction we give to your thoughts, for we do not like physical suffering, but all this is of little importance to the life you have chosen. The true and sole fatality consists in the hour at which you have to appear in, and disappear from, the sphere of corporeal life. Are there incidents which must necessarily occur in a life, and that spirits will not avert? Yes, but those incidents you, in your spirit state, foresaw when you made your choice. But, nevertheless, you must not suppose that everything which happens to you was written, as people express it. An event is often the consequence of something you have done by an act of your free will, so that, had you not done that thing, the event would not have taken place. If you burn your finger, it is not because such an incident was preordained, for it is a trifling inconvenience resulting from your own carelessness, and a consequence of the laws of matter. It is only the great sorrows, the events of serious importance and capable of influencing your moral state, that are foreordained by God, because they will be useful to your purification and instruction. 860. Can a man, by his will and his efforts, prevent events that were to have occurred from taking place, and vice versa? He can do so if this seeming deviation is compatible with the life he has chosen. And, in order to do good, which should be, and is, the sole end of life, he may prevent evil, especially that which might contribute to a still greater evil. 861. Did the man who commits a murder know, in choosing his existence, that he would become a murderer? No, he knew that, by choosing a life of struggle, he incurred the risk of killing one of his fellow creatures, but he did not know whether he would, or would not, do so, for there is, almost always, deliberation in the murderer's mind before committing the crime, and he who deliberates is, evidently, free to do or not to do. If a spirit knew beforehand that he would commit a murder, it would imply that he was predestined to commit that crime. No one is ever predestined to commit a crime, and every crime, like every other action, is always the result of determination and free will. You are all too apt to confound two things essentially distinct: the events of material life, and the acts of moral life. If there is, sometimes, a sort of fatality, it is only in those events of your material life of which the cause is beyond your action, and independent of your will. A5 To the acts of the moral life, they always emanate from the man himself, who, consequently, has always the freedom of choice, in those acts, therefore, there is never fatality. 862. There are persons who never succeed in anything, and who seem to be pursued by an evil genius in all their undertakings. Is there not, in such cases, something that may be called a fatality? It is certainly a fatality, if you like to call it so, but it results from the choice of the kind of existence made by those persons in the spirit state, because they desire to exercise their patience and resignation by a life of disappointment. But you must not suppose that this fatality is absolute, for it is often the consequence of a man's having taken a wrong path, one that is not adapted to his intelligence and aptitudes. He who tries to cross a river without knowing how to swim stands a very good chance of drowning, and the same may be said in regard to the greater part of the events of your life. If a man undertook only the things that are in harmony with his faculties, he would almost always succeed. What causes his failure is his conceit and ambition, which draw him out of his proper path, and make him mistake for a vocation what is only a desire to satisfy those passions. He fails, and through his own fault, but, instead of blaming himself, he prefers to accuse his star. One who might have been a good workman, and earned his bread honorably in that capacity, prefers to make bad poetry, and dies of starvation. There would be a place for everyone, if everyone put himself in his right place. 863. Do not social habits often oblige a man to follow one road rather than another, and is not his choice of occupation often controlled by the opinion of those about him? Is not the sentiment which leads us to attach a certain amount of importance to the judgment of others an obstacle to the exercise of our free will? Social habits are made, not by God, but by men. If men submit to them, it is because it suits them to do so, and their submission is therefore an act of their free will, since, if they wish to enfranchise themselves from those habits, they could do so. Why, then, do they complain? It is not social habits that they should accuse, but their pride, which makes them prefer to starve rather than to derogate from what they consider to be their dignity. Nobody thanks them for this sacrifice to opinion, though God would take note of the sacrifice of their vanity. We do not mean to say that you should brave public opinion unnecessarily, like certain persons who possess more eccentricity than true philosophy. There is as much absurdity in causing yourself to be pointed at as an oddity, or stared at as a curious animal, as there is wisdom in descending, voluntarily and unmurmuringly, when you are unable to maintain yourself at the top of the social ladder. 864. If there are persons to whom fate is unpropitious, there are others who seem to be favored by fortune, for they succeed in everything they undertake. To what is this to be attributed? In many cases, to their skillful management of their affairs, but it may also be a species of trial. People are often intoxicated by success, they put their trust in their destiny, and pay in the curl for their former successes by severe reverses, which greater prudence would have enabled them to avoid. 865. How can we account for the run of luck that sometimes favors people under circumstances with which neither the will nor the intelligence have anything to do, in games of hazard, for instance? Certain spirits have chosen beforehand certain sorts of pleasure, the luck that favors them is a temptation. He who wins as a man often loses as a spirit, such kick is a trial for his vanity and his cupidity. 866. The fatality which seems to shape our material destinies is, then, a result of our free will. You, yourself, have chosen your trial, the severer it is, and the better you bear it, the higher you do raise yourself. Those who pass their lives in the selfish enjoyment of plenty and of human happiness are cowardly spirits who remain stationary. Thus the number of those who are unfortunate is much greater, in your world, than of those who are fortunate, because spirits generally make choice of the trial that will be most useful to them. They see too clearly the futility of your grandeurs and your enjoyments. Besides, the most fortunate life is always more or less agitated, more or less troubled, if only by the absence of sorrow. 867. Whence conies the expressions born under a lucky star? From an old superstition that connected the stars with the destiny of each human being, a figure that some people are silly enough to take for literal truth. 868. Can the future be revealed to man? As a rule, the future is hidden from him. It is only in rare and exceptional cases that God permits it to be revealed. 869. Why is the future hidden from man? If man knew the future, he would neglect the present, and would not act with the same freedom, because he would be swayed by the thought that, if such and such a thing is to happen, there is no need to occupy oneself about it, or else he would seek to prevent it. God has willed that it should not be thus, in order that each may concur in the accomplishment of the designs of Providence, even of those which he would desire to thwart, and thus you, yourselves, often prepare the way, without your knowing it, for the events that will occur in the course of your life. 870. Since it is useful that the future should be hidden, why does God sometimes permit it to be revealed? Because in such cases this foreknowledge, instead of hindering the accomplishment of the thing that is to be, will facilitate it, by inducing the person to whom it is revealed to act in a different way from that in which he would otherwise have acted. And, besides, it is often a trial. The prospect of an event may awaken thoughts more or less virtuous. If a man becomes aware, for instance, that he will succeed to an inheritance which he had not expected, he may be tempted by a feeling of cupidity, by elation at the prospect of adding to his earthly pleasures, by a desire for the death of him to whose fortune he will succeed, in order that he may obtain possession of it more speedily, or, on the other hand, this prospect may awaken in him only good and generous thoughts. If the prediction be not fulfilled, it is another trial, that of the way in which he will bear the disappointment, but he will none the less have acquired the merit or the blame of the good or bad thoughts awakened in him by his expectation of the event predicted. 871. Since God knows everything, he knows whether an unwill or will not fail in a given trial. Where then is the use of this trial, since it can show God nothing that he does not already know in regard to that man? You might as well ask why God did not create man accomplished, perfect, or why man has to pass through childhood before arriving at adult age. The aim of trial is not to enlighten God in regard to man's deserts, for God knows exactly what they are, but to leave to man the entire responsibility of his conduct, since he is free to do or not to do. Man having fret choice between good and evil, trial serves to bring him under the action of temptation, and thus to give him the merit of resistance, for God, though knowing beforehand whether he will triumph or succumb, cannot, being just, either reward or punish him otherwise than according to the deeds he has done. 872. The question of free will may be thus summed up: man is not fatally led into evil, the acts he accomplishes are not written down beforehand, the crimes he commits are not the result of any degree of destiny. He may have chosen, as trial and as expiation, an existence in which, through the surroundings amidst which he is placed, or the circumstances that supervene, he will be tempted to do wrong, but he always remains free to do or not to do.